When my time at Yale came to an end, I had a simple but poignant and very curious experience. Even though I was living and working in New York, my whole life had previously been about school. And after Yale, I actually felt disoriented, like I'd lost my connection to the world.
Let me show you around the place a little bit. Oh, wow! Hey, man, where all those little people with the melty hats and the walls go? Hey, hey, man, now that you're so old, down home, travel and all that, I'm gonna take you up to the second Bardo and orient you.
We three kings of Orient are.
Edward Said was one of the most important cultural figures of the late 20th century. In his 1978 book, Orientalism, Said made the influential argument that scholarly writing from America and Europe presented inaccurate, misleading, and stereotyped cultural representations of the East. He argued that the Orient is the stage on which the whole East is confined. Said believed these biased perceptions hindered a true understanding of Middle Eastern and East Asian culture. To understand Said's theory, let's imagine a scholarly university professor writing an academic report on the party scene. For research purposes, he decides to go to a party. When he arrives, the party is in full swing. Most guests are casually dressed and dancing to loud electronic dance music. Others are sitting around lounging on the floor, kissing and laughing. The whole situation is alien to the professor. He has his own set of values and finds it difficult to understand or appreciate the behavior of the partygoers. He can't identify himself with them or understand what made them who they are.
One of the more surreal things that occurred this weekend, yes, was the meeting of a man named Stefan at a party, a laser beam party, on
weird.
The 28th
weird.
Floor of Building C
weird.
In the Barrington Plaza. We were showing laser beam patterns of bubbled plastic pieces on a movie screen and later on the wall. And in came Stefan and your friend Mike.
Ford.
Yep, Mike Ford and Ralph and Frida. And
I know them,
Well, Stefan is supposed to... Let me finish
Toyota
the story,
dealer.
Please.
That's right. Go ahead.
Stefan is supposed to be a German pianist who speaks only Korean.
While killing time in my room at the Palace of Imps between meals, I turned on the TV and found what appeared to be a local food show. Three cartoonized men in striped prison clothes being chased by a lion. The three cartoon characters now appear as real men, identified as Mo Hawksbreath, a man with a colorful collection of hair attempting architecture on his head, Suetonius, sooty white man, who looked like Colonel Sanders if the colonel had made his fortune selling Kentucky Fried Tofu, and Max Legroom, former food critic from a big city, whose brain maintained big ripples in a small pond of knowledge. The producer, identified as F. Stop Fitzgerald, introduced the first restaurant the food chain gang would review. Dear Lederhosen, the first Korean-German restaurant in Vegas. How was it? F. Stop asked. I started out with a Gangnam-style schnitzel. It made me think I was riding a horse and invading Poland, commented Sooty. I had the Ludwig van Bibimbap, said Max. It's still thundering on my palate. I read on Yelp that it was originally called the Berlin Bibimbap during the soft opening. No one seemed to mind the wall between the vegetables and the rice, but the piece of beef in the shape of Hitler's mustache struck people as tacky, so they changed the name, Mo reported. Now it's two pieces of beef in the shape of Beethoven's eyebrows, supposedly, added Legroom. What did you think of the sweet and sauerkraut? Asked Sooty. That was the North Korean dish, wasn't it? Asked Mo. Actually, it's a Chinese dish, but so is North Korea, explained Max. Could you figure out what was in the Volksguck burger? It was fantastic, but they wouldn't tell me what kind of meat they used. And I'm a TV restaurant critic, sniffed White Man. So, Overall, how would you rate Dear Lederhosen? Asked the producer. As Marilyn Monroe said to Jack Kennedy, take your pants off, Mr. President, concluded Max Legroom, speaking for all the critics. Next up, Penguin Palooza. Was it really Krillicious? Asked the camera setting disguised as a human. I've never seen Arctic char so charred, Suetonius shuddered. I couldn't find a place in the hotel parking lot, so I was late, explained Max. No legroom at the inn? Asked Suti. Penguins are too cute to eat, so why are they on the menu? Wondered Hawksbreath. I agree with the man with the parakeet landing zone on his head, said the tofu torturer. You're not supposed to agree, you're supposed to argue. Earn your booze coupons, said the irate producer. You are the only one of us with a weapon. You should have skewered the chef with your hair. Did you chicken out, bird brain? White man taunted Hawksbreath. His camera-ready Kentucky Fried Fury sparked less by his chagrin at his fellow critic's faux pas than by the possibility of a smaller paycheck. At least I have a brain, retorted Moe. The sponsor, Lazarus of Las Vegas, let us freeze you into eternity, smiled avariciously. We have a question from the live chat room. A cat wants to know if it's real penguin meat, relays F-stop. To paraphrase the famous New Yorker cartoon, on the internet, no one knows you're a cat, quotes Max, always happy to display his vast knowledge. Yes, real as death, pulverized penguin pancreas no less. Who could make that up? You'd have to be a cat to eat it, protests Suti. So, summing up, insisted F-stop, trying to speed up the show and get it to a bar, as Greta Garbo said to Jack Kennedy, put your pants on, Mr. President, summed Max as the credits came up.
He's about a 35 or 36-year-old man. He looks American, I guess. He spoke only Korean during the evening, and the only American words that he knew were hello and Dana Andrews. He apparently sits for hours in front of the television set. He sets his alarm for 6 in the morning, gets up, and spends a day in the tube. What he loves most of all is watching the numbers flip over on Jeopardy. The numbers flip over. And he taught me.
How did you interpret it from Korean?
You did. I called you up and asked you for the Korean phrases that the Marine had taught you.
Yeah, right, and that was enough for you to get that on.
Yeah, it was enough for me to establish some kind of weird communication with him. And I must preface all of this by saying that to this very moment, I do not know, in actual fact, whether or not I was being put on or this is a real situation. Ralph and Frida told me that Stefan has been living at their house for 5 months without working. He will not talk, you see. He only speaks Korean, and apparently they don't know. They've tried to communicate with him, but they can't. So he either has a really good thing going, see, or he is truly... Anyway, I tested him as best I could, knowing only a few phrases that Mr. Bergman told me. One was Toxon Dingy Dingy, which is a big drunk. And Scoshy Dingy Dingy, these got tremendous reactions from him. Tremendous, and thinking, oh, I know, you know, very excited. And then I followed that with Tuxan Mama-san, a big mama, which he didn't seem to relate to too much. Being raised by Korean parents, I guess he didn't meet any of these big mamas.
Didn't like his Tuxan Mama.
And Idiwa Shipsha, which was given a rather picturesque translation by your Marine friend of hurry up, which is was actually means, Idiwa Shipsha, come here quickly. Well, and he gestured to me, come here and burbled a few more words in Korean. He taught me some Korean phrases, and out of these Korean phrases, I determined a very interesting fact. The reason why we call the Koreans and the Chinese and people of the slant-eyed persuasion gooks. This is the reason why. The word for Korean is Hanguk. The word for American is meguk, and the word for Chinese is chungguk.
Guk must mean man.
Something like that. Well, hanguk or language, I'm not sure.
Fred thought it came from geek, but that sounds better, much better.
Sure, that's obviously it. Yeah. And you know something, in the Korean War,
I was talking to Fred, I said, what was the names of the Koreans you were fighting? He said, gooks. I said, well, what were the names of the Koreans you were, what'd you call the Koreans you were fighting with? Gooks. He said, everybody said the Greeks were gooks, the Italians were gooks, the Turkish were gooks, the Australians, he said, were gooks. He said, if somebody was a forward observer with a Australian lieutenant, yeah. He'd hear back,
it's a red bullet here, I'm F.O. with a gook.
That's it.
F.O. with the gook.
Forward observing with a gook. An Aussie, right? A guy who won't let gooks into his country.
What about the gooks?
Bad news, Lieutenant. There are gooks all around here.
They live here, Lieutenant. They got women and pigs and gardens and everything.
I was talking to this one little gook.
That's swell, Corporal Kidd, but we got orders to surround these little gooks.
That'll be easy, Lieutenant. There's millions of them on all three sides of us.
That means we got those little gooks right where we want them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and tonight's the planting moon. Several one of them is going to be out waiting in the paddies.
Me too.
In the same way, Said argued, when Western scholars studied Eastern culture, they couldn't understand it because it differed from their own. So they portrayed the East as exotic, enigmatic, and curious, judging and romanticizing it without ever understanding it. Deep down, the professor feels his values are justified. After all, he is an academic. His distaste for the partygoer's lifestyle confirms to him that his perspective is correct. He publishes his report, portraying the partygoers as raucous, sensual, uncultured, and unintelligent, because they deviated from his own personal values.
Let me turn you on to medium rare, mystic chef and guru.
Welcome to my humble chuck wagon. While you are here, we will have everything from soup to nuts. Tonight, we have mushroom soup and beetle nuts. Here, have some grubs. Oh, they are very tender baby worms, cooked over incense in holy corn oil. That's oil from the corns of holy men, known in your country as polyunsaturated ghee.
Just as the professor saw himself as superior to the partygoers, Said believed the West thought its society was superior to Eastern society. But Said went further. He thought Western scholarship held strong ties to the domineering imperialist societies that produced it, concluding that much Western scholarship was inherently political and intellectually dubious. Said argued that stereotyping became a justification for the Western colonization of Eastern countries. The West painted a picture of an Eastern world that needed civilizing. Invasion was framed as salvation, rescuing the inhabitants who were too lazy and too pleasure-focused to be fit to govern themselves. Said deduced that either the West is blinded by its own failings and doesn't recognize it as stereotyping, or it believes its own culture is superior. Edward Said's book became the foundational text for post-colonial studies and transformed Middle Eastern studies. His theory still remains critically relevant today, so much so that it has become part of our language. The term Orientalism describes a patronizing Western attitude towards other cultures.
So, one day, I took a train back up to New Haven to visit the campus again, to see the leaves turning colors on the trees, to tell myself, yes, it's fall, but you are no longer in school. It's fall, and you are now a working professional actor. The landmarks for the passage of time in your life have changed forever. That summer at Denison really groomed me even further for the life of an actor. It was very hard work, both rehearsing and performing simultaneously. In one show, I'd be singing a lead role, and in the next, playing a Chinese waiter, complete with Asiatic eye makeup and a self-crafted Fu Manchu mustache.
You have been tried and condemned of crimes almost without number. Your efforts to build an empire of crime have today brought you to the end you so richly deserve. Death to Fu Manchu.
The face of Fu Manchu.
There's a man whom I thought was dead. Now I believe he's still alive. He's cruel, callous, brilliant, and the most evil and dangerous man in the world.
He used as his most trusted servants a gang of Burmese dacoits and taught them to strangle their victims with these prayer scarves from Tibet.
From this fog-shrouded graveyard in London's Limehouse, the evil genius of Dr. Fu Manchu stalks its victims. Christopher Lee as the merciless Dr. Fu Manchu, who cast a black shadow of fear across innocent lives.
Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you really just a shadow?
This is Radio Free Oz. And now, we return you to Act 3 of the exciting conclusion of this week's mystery, The Poison Puff, with our guest super sleuth, Charlie Chance. In the lovely Victorian greenhouse of the late Dr. Anslinger, Charlie Chance has gathered together all of the possible suspects of this week's heinous crime. As his long, delicate fingers unhook the top frog of his richly embroidered Mandarin kimono due to the excessive humidity, we hear him say,
You may all be wondering why I have gathered you together in the late doctor's lovely Victorian greenhouse at such a late hour. You see, just as I was drifting off to sleep, the elements of this heinous crime suddenly locked themselves together like the pieces of an ancient Chinese puzzle.
I say, Mr. Chance, can't we get this damnable business over with so that we can all go back to our beds?
No one appreciates better than I the lateness of the hour. But you, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, as the sole partner of the late Dr. Anslinger and the co-owner of his vast botanical patents, should be particularly interested in, shall I say, rooting out the culprit.
I don't know what I'm doing here. I got enough on me hands keeping Mulch Manor clean.
And who but you, Nurse Warren, as the lifelong companion and trusted confidant of the murdered man, would know better the hidden nooks and crannies of this ill-fated domicile.
Right you are, Chance. I've never liked that woman, and I've always suspected that all she wanted was the doctor's money.
Why, Mr. Mossbank?
Mr. Mossbank, you would do well to remember the old Chinese proverb, He who works in glass greenhouse should not get stoned. Is it not common knowledge that as the doctor's botanical assistant for 14 years, you were jealous of his position and honors and disappointed by your lack of achievement?
Oh, Harry, I know you didn't do it. Why, we were to be married in this very greenhouse.
I sympathize with your concern for the doctor's assistant, Harry Mossbach, niece Wendy Simmons. But is it not true that just before the unfortunate doctor's life was snuffed out, he was in the process of rewriting his will that would have cut you off without a farthing had you married his assistant?
The doctor and I were discussing a more fitting match for the lovely Miss Wendy.
Oh.
Hawthorne Heathcliff, you bounder?
Gentlemen, gentlemen, let us review the facts. On the night of October 7th...
Eight.
Thank you, number one son. In this greenhouse, Dr. Anslinger was deeply absorbed in completing the final experiments on what was to be the most significant of his many botanical achievements. The first successful transplanting above the Tropic of Cancer of the virtually extinct herb Argentum Cannibal Vulgaris, or Glistening Javanese Bogfink. The one known cure for asthma.
Oh, the poor man, he suffered from it all his life.
He suffers no more.
Oh.
Because late last night, While the doctor was in a remote corner of the greenhouse, watering his rare orchids organically, one of you snuck in here, crept over to the doctor's work table, opened the golden cigarette case in which the doctor kept his daily supply of Asmodor cigarettes, his sole relief from the racking pains of asthma, and replaced the contents with cigarettes of their own making. They did not contain Asmodor. Oh, no. But poison oak. The doctor returned to his work table, lit one of the counterfeit cigarettes, treated himself to a long, poisoned puff, hallucinated briefly, and died of the fantastic complications.
Why, only a monster would do that.
Yes, indeed. Only a monster. The doctor returned to his work table, lit one of the counterfeit cigarettes, treated himself to a long, poisoned puff, hallucinated briefly, and died of the fantastic complications.
Why, only a monster would do that.
Yes, indeed. Only a monster. And a very clever monster at that. And now, my friends, I am going to place the finger of justice on that monster.
Can Charlie Chan unravel the incredibly knotted web of this insidious, not to say heinous crime?
I told you not to say that.
With the only few meager clues at his command. As he steps forward, his long, delicate fingers unhooking the second frog of his richly embroidered mandarin kimono, we hear him say...
Finger. Unbeknownst to all of you, I visited your separate bedrooms this evening and extracted scrapings from beneath your fingernails. From beneath your fingernails, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, I recovered these scrapings. They look remarkably like Asmodor, do they not?
No, they're nothing of the sort.
Exactly so. By quick chemical analysis, I've determined them to be a common oriental drug. You are not the murderer, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, but you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Your fingernails yielded nothing, Nurse Warren.
Oh, I should think not. I ain't got no fingernails.
But I could not help but notice that your fingers were entirely covered with blisters, similar to those produced by poison oak.
Oh, that's from all the scrubbing of the pots and pans in Bloody Mulch Manor.
Of course. You have no need to fear accusation. What you need is a new detergent. But you, Harry Mossback, I hold in this envelope the scrapings from beneath your fingernails. They are, without a doubt, glistening Javanese bog think.
It's true. I snuck in last night and stole the doctor's prize specimen. I was tired of being an assistant all my life. And anyway, the bog think was mine. Yes, I stole it, but I wouldn't kill the old man. He was like a father to me. As a matter of fact, he was my father.
Then, Harry, that means we can never be married. Oh, it can't be true.
Oh, but it is true. Harry would never have killed his father. And you, Wendy, had nothing to gain. That leaves only...
What are you talking about, Chan? There are no suspects left.
None except Arthur, the butler.
I'm not even in the script. I'm just standing over here with my hands in my pockets watching the whole thing unfold as it was.
With your hands in your pockets.
Yeah.
And that's where the elements in this heinous crime suddenly lock together like the pieces of an ancient Chinese puzzle. When I examined the golden cigarette case, I was puzzled by the complete lack of fingerprints. At first, I thought the murderer must have worn gloves, but this is not the season for gloves. And then it came to me. No fingerprints could only mean that the murderer had no hands. Take your hands out of your pockets, Mr. Arthur.
Now, wait a minute. I've got nothing to hide.
Precisely. You have nothing to hide, as everyone can see now, because you have no hands. Inspector Gridley, take him away. The mystery is solved.
I
And so, unhooking the final frog of his richly embroidered Mandarin kimono and smiling his inscrutable smile, Charlie Chance brings to a close another exciting episode of Who Done Did It. Be with us next week when our guest super sleuth, Sam Spade, tackles the case of the Maltese Chitlin.
I remember riding on the bus and looking out the window because there's nothing else to do. And I'm sitting there looking out the window at the markets as they go by. And here's how poor people were. There were hand-lettered signs on the windows for the markets, the meat markets and various like. And it said, bucket of hog maws, $1. If you don't know what a hog maw is the mouth of the hog. Pig's feet, $1 a bucket. Chitlins, which are, of course, chitterlings to us white folks. But chitlins, it's the worst thing in the world. And chitlins you eat when you can't get steak. Nobody eats chitlins voluntarily. I mean, it may be soul food to a lot of people, and they may have romanticized it. But chitlins, I'd rather have a marlin spike driven through the left side of my head than have to eat chitlins. And there was a big sign, chitlins, $1. Much as you can carry in a pail, a bucket. You would bring a lunch bucket and fill it up with chitlins, which is all the crap that was left over from the pigs after they slaughtered them. Well, I got out, can't remember where it was, way deep in the south side, and walked down the street and went up the stairs to Pony's apartment. And I could smell chitlins cooking or frying or deep fatting or whatever the hell they did with them, purifying them somehow. And I tell you, I had to stop on the staircase because my gorge became buoyant. And it's a memory, a sensory memory that I can recall as clearly as if it was yesterday. And I got up there and we had the big party.
After school, I did professional touring stock too. And that's when I had the chance to work with a very kind, marvelously talented Pat O'Brien. I remember we played in the Tri-City area of upstate New York, Corning, Johnson City, and Troy. O'Brien had a big party at every city we hit. He was well known for his film work, and veterans loved him for his USO tours.
I've been being told that we're to return to the floor of the convention now, where General D.C. Blame of the Veterans Tap Dance Administration has now already begun his address to the sleeping delegates. This is General Blame.
The toilet was hopelessly clogged, and both our parachutes are still at the cleaners. What's that, I said, pointing to a clearing ahead. My co-pilot, God, replied, that's the Burma oil field. Well, hell, I said, don't the Japs get fuel from there? Sure, said God, everybody knows that. Well, then I said, let's drop our bombs on them. Well, God looked at me and said, Colonel, you fool, sir, we can't do that. The British own those oil fields and they're our allies. Well, sir, we had a good laugh over that one. We dropped our load on a herd of cows near Fiji and belly flopped somewhere in the ocean. It was a good landing, but God was killed. And of course, I survived and floated to shore using his body as ballast. I tell you, that was one of the wildest theaters of war I ever played in.
Well, it's like in the war movies, the ones in the planes. Every time they cut the film so that you see the Japanese guns first, right? You know the guy in the American plane is going to get hit, right? Every time they show the American guns, the Jap goes. About a 3-to-1 ratio.
Somewhere in the South Pacific, 1943.
Two.
Captain! Captain, fighter planes at 12 o'clock, sir.
Don't worry, bosun. It's only 11:30. Give me my binoculars. By God, they're Japanese!
The planes?
No, my binoculars. Now, don't worry, men. The planes are flying farther and farther away. Bye!
Oh, Captain, turn your binoculars around.
Thank you, Henderson. I got you right. They're getting closer and closer. Dive!
Dive!
That's an order! Dive!
Dive!
Okay.
Captain! Captain, begging your permission, sir.
Beg away?
The men have asked me to tell you, this is in the submarine.
The Firesign Theater.
He wore an aluminum bracelet that came from the tail section of a Japanese Zero that had been shot down in the Pacific while he'd been performing, with the name of the battalion etched into it. Well, at one of these promotional events, a guy came up to him and said, "Pat, you won't remember me," and Pat O'Brien interrupted him and stated the man's rank and name. "You shot down this plane, the tail section of which I'm wearing right now on my wrist." "Right," said the soldier, beaming with pride. He looked like he was going to burst with happiness.